supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Changing neighborhoods in Philadelphia have long generated tensions between newcomers and longtime residents. The issue of gentrification was invoked in two neighborhoods Monday in serious incidents of vandalism and arson. Authorities are still searching for the suspects who set fire to an upscale townhome project in Point Breeze, burning half of it to the ground. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, the developer says the arson caused millions of dollars in damage.
For years, Point Breeze residents have been getting whiter and wealthier, and neighborhood critics say working-class black residents have been pushed out. To activists, this project was a glaring example of that trend. Longtime affordable housing advocate Claudia Smith-Sherrod leads the group South Philadelphia Homes.
Their houses are going for $600,000. That's an insult to the people who can't afford $200,000.
Sherrod and other community members spoke out against the project at public hearings but couldn't stop it. Just weeks ago, flyers were circulating in the community attacking the developer. They read, quote, "Gentrification is modern-day colonialism." The three-story townhomes under construction at 20th and Wharton Streets stand in stark contrast to the older row homes that surround them. What did Sherrod make of the arson?
I would never, ever support anybody burning anyone's property down.
She said she thinks people from outside the community were the perpetrators, trying to act on behalf of frustrated Point Breeze residents.
That is really sick. They're not doing it in behalf of us, because if they was doing it in behalf of us, no brick would have been laid.
When Point Breeze resident Dayan Hayes heard about the fire, she had this reaction.
He got to go. He got to go.
She's talking about developer and one-time city council candidate Ori Feibusch, whose projects have generated a fair amount of pushback in Point Breeze. To Feibusch, Hayes says,
go back to where you came from, my man, and go back to where them people can afford the houses and the taxes, because we're not going to be able to afford these taxes soon. So you're actually trying to push us out. That's not cool.
Feibusch admits that the townhomes are pricey, but says he's just responding to buyer demand and that he shouldn't be scapegoated for problems that run deeper than one developer.
To suggest that my homes have increased other people's taxes and pushed them out is tantamount to getting frustrated when a school improves in your community and suddenly your taxes go up because the neighborhood has improved.
Hours apart from the arson, there was a rash of vandalism in Kensington. And Feibusch says he thinks those perpetrators were also involved in setting his project ablaze. He describes the perpetrators like this.
Upwardly mobile white folks who grew up outside of the city, suburban individuals that came from good homes who believe that their way to promote their political persuasion is to stomp their feet and break things.
Police say that connection has not yet been established and that the investigation is ongoing. Meanwhile, Feibusch says he has increased security and is already removing rubble and beginning to rebuild. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
This week marks 4 months since Philadelphia's new tax on soda and other sweetened drinks took effect, and many stores have raised their prices. A major question, besides whether it'll survive a legal challenge from Big Soda, is whether the tax is driving people to change their behavior. WHYY's Katie Colinari talked to shoppers to find out.
My first stop was at a fresh grocer in Northwest Philly, just one block away from the border of Bala Cynwyd in Montgomery County. Najia Muhammad was just leaving the store and stopped to chat. She says she only drinks soda occasionally, but she has changed her buying habits.
Absolutely. I shop in the county.
Really? Even though you don't drink soda that much?
I don't, but it seems to me that the tax is involving more than just soda.
The 1.5 cents per ounce tax applies to regular and diet sodas, as well as sweetened juices, teas, and even some milk products. So Muhammad, who lives in Southwest Philly, says she started grocery shopping in Delaware County.
And that wasn't something you really did much before?
No. But I absolutely see the difference. You know, when I'm out shopping and I look at my receipt, I see a big increase.
Of the more than a dozen people across the city I talked to for this story, five of them told me they've started shopping outside the city.
Hell yeah. It's not worth it, dude.
Kate Wilson is a contractor who lives in Delaware County and works in Philadelphia, which has also dramatically raised its cigarette tax.
They got, what do you got, like a 20-ounce Pepsi now is going for like $2.50. That's ridiculous. Okay. I even quit smoking. I was like, you know what, man, this shit is by half my paycheck every week.
But for every person who said they were shopping outside the city, there were others who told me they don't mind paying the tax. Alfred Sheed from West Philly was walking down Market Street drinking a carton of Arctic Splash sweet tea.
I buy every day, so it really doesn't affect me. A few cents, I don't mind helping the cause.
Most of the money is supposed to go toward expanding subsidized preschool for 3- and 4-year-olds and major renovations at city parks, rec centers, and libraries.
I'm one of those. You know, if it goes to schools, I'm very happy.
Lisa Brownstein from West Mount Airy shops at Weaver's Way Co-op. She doesn't drink soda, but she does buy sweetened almond milk. Brownstein thinks those trying to avoid the tax are doing a disservice.
It's very interesting. I do a mentoring program in Philadelphia at the schools, and we bring beverages and snacks to the kids, and someone whose turn it is next week to bring us snacks at Go Buy Soda Outside the City. And that, like, turned me right off. And I don't think we should be buying soda for kids anyway, so.
Therein lies the conundrum. Many of those who support the tax say they think people shouldn't be drinking sugary beverages anyway. But if people stop buying taxed items in Philadelphia, will it generate enough revenue to support the programs it's supposed to fund? So far, the tax has brought in just over $19 million. The city's revenue department has estimated a 30% drop in consumption for the first year and says it's on track to meet its financial goals. And while my unscientific survey is exactly that, the city and public health researchers from Penn and Harvard are embarking on a 3-year study to find out just how the tax is affecting what people are buying and drinking. Preliminary results are expected in the fall. Katie Colinari, WHYY News.
Every state in the country offers tax breaks and other incentives to lure business to their communities and create jobs. One estimate found the programs cost states as much as $40 billion a year in uncollected taxes. But do they work? In a new study, the Pew Charitable Trusts found a lot of states just don't know because they don't rigorously evaluate their incentive programs. Earlier today, WHYY's Dave Davies sat down with Pew Research Officer Josh Goodman to talk about the study and how the states in our region are doing.
Well, Josh Goodman, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight. I think most people would assume that since legislatures are offering these incentives and giving up a lot of tax credits in hopes of creating jobs, I think most people would assume states have been measuring this. Have they not been doing a good job at it?
Until very recently, it's actually been quite uncommon for states to measure the results of their incentives. Many tax incentives don't have to be reapproved with each new state budget. So it's been incredible just in the last 5 years to see that 21 states have approved laws that require regular evaluation just in that time. And others have been, that had longer standing processes have been adopting improvements to those processes.
You put states into three categories: leading, which is good, making progress, less good, and then trailing, where all three of the states in our broadcast area find themselves. What's the difference?
The leading states both have a plan in place to regularly evaluate incentives, and they've also produced high-quality evaluations, evaluations that really dig into the economic impact of incentives. And then they're using that information to inform policy choices. The states that are making progress have taken the first step of making a plan. So many of them are in that group in the last 5 years that have adopted evaluation laws, and they're just now working to implement those. And then the states that are trailing don't have a plan yet. And so Delaware, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, as you mentioned, are all in that group. And in the trailing states, many of them have done maybe a one-time study of incentives. Maybe they collect data on incentives. That's certainly true of these three states. But they aren't doing regular analysis to measure the results and really figure out what's effective and what's not.
You know, I've seen a lot of economic impact programs here, and the businesses that get the benefits say, yeah, we're creating a lot of jobs. Isn't the heart of this really who's evaluating the benefits, right? If the recipient of the tax break is the one that reports the number of jobs created or saved, you're kind of inviting bogus numbers, aren't you really? I mean, how do you get a real measure?
The states that are doing this analysis are, they're looking at tax records. They're looking at records from economic development agencies. They're looking at federal records of what companies are reporting to the federal government. So from that kind of information, you can get a real sense of what companies are doing and what the results are.
And that means you really need an independent party looking at it, right? I mean, the legislators that designed the program might also have an interest in inflating its benefit.
Yeah. Typically what we found is that states are turning to nonpartisan professional staff to do these kinds of evaluations. So many states, for example, have a legislative audit office or a legislative program evaluation office. Those offices are nonpartisan. Their staff, what they do for a living is dig into the details of government programs and say what is working, what's not working.
Let's talk a bit about some of the states in our listening area. New Jersey's known for aggressively courting businesses with incentives. How do they fare in evaluating what they're doing?
New Jersey, we rated as trailing in our report. There are some preliminary steps towards evaluation. There's actually a study that the state has commissioned from experts at Rutgers University that's scheduled to be completed in 2018. But that's just a one-time study of the state's incentives. So there's no guarantee for regular information in New Jersey.
How's Pennsylvania doing?
We also rated Pennsylvania as trailing. And Pennsylvania is a state that, like New Jersey, has made major commitments to incentives. Its incentives cost Pennsylvania more than $700 million a year. And Pennsylvania has produced a number of one-time studies of incentives. And there are a number of different offices that have sort of proven they're capable of doing this analysis. They have the expertise to do it. And so it's just a matter of policymakers saying, yes, go and do this on a regular basis to give us more consistent information.
And Delaware, I think of Delaware as having such low business taxes, there's nothing to incentivize. I guess I'm wrong.
So Delaware is a state that has actually been publishing analysis of tax incentives and many other different types of tax credits, exemptions, and deductions for many years. But it doesn't collect hard data on whether the programs are working. And so we rated Delaware as trailing because this is a longstanding process that, while it produces some interesting analysis, hasn't really been useful for lawmakers in terms of improving the programs. Another thing we highlight in Delaware is that the state doesn't just use tax incentives. It also turns to cash incentives, so grants and loans. And so those are some of the major programs in the state. And if the state were to create a new and improved evaluation process, it might be worthwhile to study those programs as well.
So what you want is a regular program for rigorous evaluation and then examination of the results and then policy adjustments based on the findings.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's really what we're seeing around the country in more states. One of the things that has been really heartening to see as more and more states evaluate their incentives is that when lawmakers have good information, they use that information. Not maybe in every single instance, but in many, many cases, lawmakers are saying, hey, this is really valuable. We have a lot more information on the results of our incentives, and we're going to make adjustments based on that.
Josh Goodman, thanks so much for speaking with us on NewsWorks tonight.
My pleasure.
Josh Goodman is a research officer at the Pew Charitable Trusts.
And that was WHYY's Dave Davies. When it comes to fairness in public education, much of the emphasis is put on the resource disparities between different school districts. And this is a hallmark of Pennsylvania's school system, where wealthy districts spend a lot more on their kids than poorer districts. But imagine a system where school funding is not only equalized, but progressive, giving the most resources to schools facing the greatest challenges. Keystone Crossroads education reporter Kevin McCory went to Berlin, Germany, to explore such a system. He found that their divisions still exist, especially along a familiar landmark.
Andreas Rissmann is standing on the borderline where the Berlin Wall once stood. It's about a block from his apartment in the city's Wedding neighborhood. And today, even though the wall was turned to rubble almost 30 years ago, a dividing line still exists.
There are people, when they look this way, they think, oh my God, Wedding?
To many, Wedding is the wrong side of town, with some of Berlin's highest rates of poverty, unemployment, and migrancy. And the schools often carry a stigma, too. Rissman is a native Berliner, a single father who's had a string of on-again, off-again manual labor jobs. He sends his sixth-grade son to the school closest to his apartment, Vinita Elementary.
When my son started school, I was asked, where are you going to send him? When I answered, Vinita Elementary, they said, for God's sake, you can't do that. Why? I said, what's wrong with the school? What? Nobody was able to explain. There are too many foreigners. There is too much this, too much that.
The neighborhood where Rissman lives is part of a larger district in Berlin called Mitte. And Mitte is unique specifically because it encompasses two very stratified worlds that literally fall on either side of the former wall.
I'm going fishing. Yes, I'm going fishing.
Westerners have to flip their logic about which is which. The part that was formerly East Berlin is the wealthy side. It's the main downtown section of the city that saw a huge influx of development after reunification.
Let's go. Ice, baby.
The part of Mitte that used to be West Berlin has historically been a working-class immigrant neighborhood, and it remains so.
So where there had been the former the wall between East and West, this is now a social wall.
Matthias Brockstedt is a doctor and public health official in Mitte, whose office examines every five-year-old in the district for school readiness.
Bis 100. Wie alt bist du denn schon?
8.
Ah, und wie alt bist du?
For much of the district, the former wall runs along Bernauer Street, and he sees staggering differences depending on which side the family is from.
From the Bernauer Straße, if you are north, it's a pure Turkish area with low-income parents. And if you are 100 meters to the south, you have high-performance parents with academic backgrounds, and it's walking distance of 5 minutes, but still completely different world.
Dividing lines such as this occur all over the globe, and they're often taken for granted as an inescapable truth. Life isn't fair, and neither is the difference between school systems. It's the notion that underlies Pennsylvania's public schools, where school resources largely depend on the property wealth of the zip code. In Berlin, though, that's a dynamic that the politics won't allow.
My name is Maya Lasic. I'm a member of the Parliament of Berlin.
Lasic represents Wedding for the Social Democrats, the mainstream left-wing party.
The idea is that it doesn't matter where you come from, you can do whatever you want, and it doesn't depend on the amount of money your parents have. This is the promise we give.
That promise means Berlin takes the opposite approach to Pennsylvania when it comes to school funding. All money is raised centrally, and resources are distributed to schools based on student need. This progressive model of funding has clearly benefited schools in Berlin's poorer neighborhoods. But it hasn't been a cure-all. Even if those schools have more teachers and support, Lasic says they are still at a disadvantage because the student body is so concentrated with poverty and lacking German language fluency.
If you ask me what is the major problem of our educational system in Berlin, it's the segregation. We simply still do have segregation since, depending on the income, most of the people live separately.
In an attempt to remedy this, about a decade ago, Lasic's party began advancing a plan that was put into effect only in Mitte.
We have the possibility to mix from the higher income and the lower income families. That was the idea.
Elementary schools were grouped into different clusters. And the idea was that all parents could opt to send their kids to any of the schools in their zone. In Andreas Rissman's neighborhood, which proved most contentious, the map was drawn around three schools on his side of the social wall and four schools on the wealthier side. In theory, the politicians hoped all the schools would be integrated in a way that would raise all boats.
And how'd it go?
Everybody expected that it would be hard, but they decided to try it anyway.
For some parents, like Rissman, the idea of mixing student populations wasn't a controversy at all.
That's what I tried to instill at home, what I've tried to teach from the beginning. Kindness, politeness, tolerance.
But for many others, it proved too difficult of a pill to swallow. Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
And tomorrow we'll further explore Berlin's school integration plan and the blowback that ultimately crushed it. Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on the challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan for NewsWorks Tonight.